Session number 26580.
Wing Commander Roberts, Real 6. Now, the next post, it was in November 48. You went to Air Force Headquarters Ottawa, where you were on the Transport Air Staff, or the Air Operations Branch. This was a desk job. Can you talk? I mean, that's not what you were used to up till then. Can you talk us a bit about that?
Well, I suppose this posting followed the original Air Commodore Ray's intention that I should be moved about. And I was moved to the Transport Air Staff in Ottawa itself. And it was a desk job. My first of all since my career in the Royal Air Force. And the big job on at that particular time was writing a paper on the resupply of the Arctic Islands. At that time, the Americans were very much concerned about the Russians coming in over the north, over the Arctic, and they wanted stations in the Arctic Islands to provide weather information and other information and what have you. And the wing commander of the branch was not making a job of it at all. So his group captain took the job over writing the paper, and he got me to do the arithmetic. And he and I got on very well indeed. And I enjoyed doing the arithmetic. You know, how much resupply, how many aircraft, what type of aircraft, and where they'd be staying, all that sort of thing.
The logistics.
Yes. Yes. I enjoyed that. That poor group captain, has got Alzheimer's when I last heard of him a few years ago. But what's more, he showed me what air forces were about, apart from just flying aeroplanes.
In what way?
Well, you know, you look a map of the Arctic and you'd say, well, the Russians can come in this way and we can do this, and you know, and it was much more not just flying an aeroplane, but seeing what air forces were about.
Anything else happened while you were there? You weren't there long. You were there from November 48 to February
49. Well, I see a two-year tour, and I'd done already 2 1/4, so one had to go off back to this country in a very, very rough Atlantic. Very rough indeed. Landed at Liverpool and went back to London, where again, as in 1943, I had to report to Mr. McGee to find a posting.
Now, you mentioned a book, he was famous. I've actually not heard of him. Who was he? What was so?
Well, but I think in a small way, if you like, Mr. McGee's name was known as the chap who posted people.
So what did you get?
What did I get then? Well, the Berlin Airlift was on, and the Transport Air Staff in Air Ministry was a bit pushed. So very unusually for a flight lieutenant, I was sent into the Transport Air Staff in Air Ministry in Whitehall to assist in the, and I did most of the diplomatic clearances and things like that, where they got on with the real job.
Now, how much were you aware of what was going on with the Berlin? We'll come to that, but the Berlin airlift. I mean, were you very aware of what was happening?
Well, the chaps in the same office were busy on it all the time.
But you had nothing to do with it. You were just brought in underranked to ease the pressure on them.
That's right. That's right. Yes. Yes. So, you know, after a month or two or three...
Now, what were you actually doing, these diplomatic clearances? What did that entail?
Well, when a Royal Air Force aircraft wishes to go through a foreign country for some reason or other, one has to get diplomatic clearance for it to proceed. You can't take off and go until you've got clearance of that country to allow it in.
Was that ever a problem, or was it a formality?
I don't recall it being a problem, but whether it was a formality or not, I couldn't say, because you'd have to go to the air attaché in that country, and he had to present it to the government of that country. And whether you call that a formality or not, I wouldn't know.
So your next posting was to the Short Service Commission Selection Board after a course.
Yes, that again was very surprising, but anyway, it was still in London, and I had to go out of Hornchurch, which was a long trip by tube every day, for a fortnight to do an interviewing course.
What were you learning?
Oh, I think just the techniques of interviewing, and the most embarrassing business was of interviewing a class member in front of the class. Most embarrassing business, I found, anyway. But anyway, then we came back to the offices in Kingsway, where I think the maintenance of three or four boards, which operated daily. And the boards consisted of a group captain, a wing commander, and a squadron leader, although I was still only a flight lieutenant. And in the morning or in the afternoon, one interviewed an applicant, probably for about 40 minutes, wrote a report, and in the afternoon you then went, joined the other members of the board, read your report, a man was brought in, and he was interviewed in a normal way. Then you each wrote a little more report, and then compared the results and graded them accordingly. Now, for 1 year, that was people trying to get back in, who had been in the Royal Air Force, who were trying to get back in. Having been demobbed, were then trying to return to the Royal Air Force. And a great many of them had come home from having emigrated to Australia or to Canada or South Africa, were now home and trying to get back into the Royal Air Force. Now, the interesting thing, I asked all those people why, having emigrated, they were now back in this country. And it's surprising how many people said, my wife couldn't live without her mother. It was very interesting. Well, apart from anything else, one had all the reports written on those officers during their service time. You know, officers are reported on annually on a Form 1369.
And they're normally confidential.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But when you're interviewing these chaps, you've got to, you know, all the things. And they were very interesting, I thought, because you got a very general impression, but there was probably one report which is quite different. And you could see where there was possibly a personality clash or something like that. One man, which I remember very much, rather heavy sort of individual, who wanted to get back in. But you could see that he was a running down man. You know, you got a dirty tie on, for instance. Otherwise, RAF jacket and things. But he didn't get in, that fellow. But now, for the second year, life changed. Because we didn't have any of those people anymore. We interviewed students or recent graduates who were up for commissions in the educational branch for national service. And of course, with a chap of 19 or 20, there's not much you can get round to except to explore what they did at university, apart from the academic field. You know, one was always looking for signs of leadership in terms of, you know, were you chairman of a society or secretary of this or what have you? Delving for signs of leadership and energy.
Now, during this period, you were also studying yourself for your promotion exams.
There were, yes, promotion exams, yes. Which I attended one or two lectures, but principally I got hold of some old papers, and at home I wrote answers to them, and anyway, I got through all right.
And you were promoted to?
While I was there, I got to be acting squadron leader, I think, and then squadron leader. And then came an interesting bit, because I thought, well, I've done 2 years here, now what am I going to do next? I don't know whether other people think like this, but I tend to be a planner if I can make it. So what do I do next? Well, I had a wing commander on the board who expressed an interest. And he was an interesting case too, because he took off in the Wellington during the war, loaded with bombs, and someone had forgotten to put caps on the oil tanks. So quickly the engine stopped, and the aircraft landed straight ahead, bombs blew up, and he was blown out of the cockpit. And they had to put his feet back on again. And so he was a bit of a cripple, but doing very well. Anyway, he said, oh, well, leave it to me. And before I knew what was happening, I got a call from the PSO, Principal Personal Staff Officer, to the CNC Coastal Command. Would I come and see the CNC? Which I did. And, of course, by that time, I had a lot of hours, flying hours, and a broad experience, too, as far as flying is concerned. Anyway, the CNC thought it would be a very good idea and said, well, we've got a gap in 269 Squadron in Northern Ireland coming up. Well, Northern Ireland didn't appeal to me, but nevertheless, I went away, and then there was uproar. Because once the personnel staff found out what was going on, there was an uproar. So that didn't happen. And then, as I think I wrote in that book, the next one was a bucket of cold water, because I was posted to Scotland to do an administrative job, an organisation job, which in fact meant mostly looking after works and bricks.
Now that was to... That's not a very entrancing unit name. Headquarters Number 18 Group, Coastal Command.
That's right.
So you were joining Coastal Command.
Oh, yes, yes.
But just not in the role you'd envisioned.
That's right. There may have been some design behind that. I expect there was.
And what exactly... this was at Pitt Reeve Castle. That's near Dunfermline.
That's right. Just over the Forth from Edinburgh.
So tell us what exactly your role was with them.
Well, we had three stations. There was Kinloss, right at the north of Scotland. There was Ballykelly in Northern Ireland. There was Aldergrove in Northern Ireland. And I was principally concerned with keeping an eye on works and bricks, buildings. And it so happened that Ballykelly was being expanded at a rate, and so there was quite a lot going on there.
And how did you take to this new role?
Well, as I say, it was like a bucket of cold water, but there was a job to be done, and I got on with it.
Nothing much to report about that period, then?
Well, I forgot, you know. Talking about medals, not decorations. We go back to Bramcote in 1943. I got another medal. If you serve in one of the services in peacetime as a volunteer and do 10 years, you get a medal. Which in the Army is a TD, Territorial Decoration, and in the Navy is a VRD, Volunteer Reserve Decoration. And in the Air Force, it didn't have a name for many, many, many years and is now known as AE, Air Efficiency Award. Why it ever been named Air Efficiency, I can't imagine, because it's a volunteer decoration. But anyway, you now can put A after your name on that. So that, in due course, with various campaign medals, gave me two rows of four each. That's eight ribbons. In Petrievi, I nearly got a third row. One day my wing commander put his head round the door and he said, if you get the coronation medal, you'll have to start a third row, won't you? And that, and in fact, the chap next door got it, not me. But no, we did some flying, a little bit of flying. Well, you know, in your staff job, you're always supposed to keep, or used to always have to keep in flying trim. And in fact, the Petrievi had a Dakota. It also had an American Exchange lieutenant. And one day he and I took the Dakota up to Iceland, to Reykjavik, which was a bit dicey because when we got more than halfway or beyond the point of no return, we were told that Reykjavik was blanked out. But fortunately, the forecast was improving, and when we got there, there was still some cloud at 100 feet. And when we got back to Edinburgh, it was very thick indeed. And but anyway, we managed to. We just couldn't land at Petrieva. We had to go to London, to Edinburgh Airport. I can't recall anything. Used to go Scottish country dancing there.
So you were there till May 53.
Yes. Yes. And then I was sent off to Coast Command training. Down to Cornwall, where the School of Maritime Reconnaissance, using Lancasters, where we were taught all the things one had to know about Coastal Command, including ship recognition, for instance. And in fact, one did also a navigation course, which of course I was already a qualified navigator, but I had to do that.
Was that a waste of time, that duplication?
Well, yes, but I mean, you know, you have to do the course. And in fact, my last trip was navigating a Lancaster down to Gibraltar.
Was there anything new in navigation that was coming through? Or?
No. Well, I mean, no, there was nothing new there. And then up to Scotland, right up to Kinloss, to learn to be converted to the Shackleton.
Now, this was the number 236 operational conversion unit?
Yes.
At Kinloss, is it?
Yes. And I don't know how, I can't remember how much time we spent there, not an awful lot of time, just to convert to the Shackleton.
Now, the Shackleton was going to be important to you for the rest of your career, or quite a bit of
yes,
it. What
yes.
did you think of the Shackleton, which one? They're different marks.
Well, this was the Mark I, which later became the Mark IV trainer. And it was a pretty crude aircraft, I thought. Pretty crude aircraft. When I got, then I was appointed, and I think I'd known this for some time, I was appointed to command number 224 squadron in Gibraltar. And when I got there, the squadron had both Mark 1s and Mark 2s. The Mark 2 was a nicer aircraft to fly. Certainly much easier to do a nice landing with it.
Well, let's go on to the period. That was from October 53 to May 55, a good posting too. And you were going to be the commanding officer, the squadron leader of 224 Squadron.
Yes.
Could you tell us, I mean, was that seen as the best posting that you could get to be a squadron leader? I mean, was that in one of the peaks of your service?
Oh, yes, indeed. I mean, you don't get promoted anywhere unless you do a commanding job like that. In the two ranks of squadron leader, wing commander. That's something you have to do in order to progress with a career.
Now, what was the setup at Gibraltar? Where was the because it was difficult, the station, wasn't it, in the sense of the way it was laid out in the airfield?
Well, it's certainly very difficult. It's very difficult to describe Gibraltar unless you've got a picture or can have been there. But the runway is between the rock and the Spanish border. And over the years, from the 1940s onwards, it had been extended to the point where it was about 2,000 yards. And on the west end, stuck out into the harbour. The east end had a sort of hump on it just to keep the sea out, which took one or two aircrafts undercarriages off, I think, over the years. But anyway, 224 Squadron. Now, I'd never had a command before. My predecessor was a very popular man, which made life even more difficult. My station commander drank too much at lunchtime every day. But fortunately, he didn't last very long, and I got a new station commander, the station being called North Front. And he insisted that not only was I the squadron commander, but I was also OC Flying Wing. In other words, the airfield was mine. And this was important because if you get a southwesterly, southeasterly wind in Gibraltar, the air downwind of the rock gets so turbulent that it's dangerous to approach and land. So there were times when I had to decide whether the airfield was closed or open because of that. Otherwise, and what's more, because of that, I had a flight lieutenant established as an adjutant, which was outside the squadron. Until a board came along and said you can't have him, so I had to take somebody from the squadron to do the same job because he had a job to do, no doubt about that. Right, squadron commander. I did two things which eventually spread to the rest of the command by copying, I imagine, but it spread nevertheless. First of all, each squadron at that time had a number of servicing airmen attached.
They're the ones who've maintained the aircraft?
Yes, yeah, apart from major overhauls. And those people were in the squadron, but apparently not of it. So I immediately I had two flights, A and B flights. They're both of flying crews, four each, I think, or three each, I can't remember now. So I made the airman of the squadron C flight and put one of my chaps in charge. So the boys then felt they were part of the squadron. Also got the squadron badge put on the rudder of each aircraft. And both those things spread throughout the command from me starting it.
Now, why did you put the squadron badge on?
Well, it's a matter of, you know, it's like a medieval knight going into battle. He carries his what you call it, you know, he carries on his shield, he's got his thing. So we go into battle, we have our shield on the aircraft. All squadrons in Coastal Command were extremely busy outfits. I no sooner hardly arrived there when we went off to Northern Ireland. The squadron went off to Northern Ireland, or some part of it, I can't remember, to Northern Ireland to the joint anti-submarine school, which each squadron went to, I don't know, whether once a year or once every so often anyway. And also part of the course was the 4th Destroyer Squadron, which I got to know in Gibraltar.
What were you doing there? Why did they need a whole squadron? What exactly were you doing?
Well, we were training in chasing submarines. Techniques. Manoeuvres. Solid boys. Another thing which all the squadrons did about once a year was go to Malta, where there were Royal Navy submarines and the water was clear and the weather good, so we could chase submarines, practice chasing submarines there.
Now, what was your cooperation like with the Royal Navy?
Well, we would always go out in Royal Naval ships. They very rarely wanted to fly with us. I think on an individual basis, no problems at all.
The things that you mentioned in your book are that you weren't willing to pull drugs for them to shoot at, and that they weren't willing to provide submarines for you to train with. Although you do mention that both these things were resolved one way or another, but...
Well, what I think the point was, we were all too busy doing our own thing. You know, we'd all got a programme, a schedule to do this, to do that and the other, and... I went afloat on naval ships from Gibraltar, which was very interesting.
Another thing, that you went on various flights. Do you want to, I don't know whether any spring to mind. You seem to have done about a certain amount, quite a bit of flying still.
Well, if you're a squadron commander, you're a busy chap, and you don't get the time to do as much flying, but I suppose that while I was a squadron commander, I put in about 300 hours a year flying. Not a great deal, but one kept one's hands in.
Were they routine flights or special flights?
Some were routine, some were special. I mean, I think it's true to say, can't remember whether it was Gibraltar or Blaise or St. Morgan. We did an air sea rescue escort on Princess Margaret flying across the Atlantic. That was from St. Morgan, wasn't it, later? There was a search and rescue trip to a burning liner, which I can't remember the name. It was a troop ship. Troop ship went on fire some way east of Gibraltar, and we went and flew out to see that one.
What sort of flights were the squadron doing? I mean, what would it spend its time doing in the air?
Well, an awful lot was continuation training. You know, practicing the manoeuvres which you did in an aircraft. Approach and landings and three-engine flying and instrument flying.
And one flight you was a royal flypast, didn't you?
That's right. Well, the Queen came to Gibraltar, what, in 1952, I think, probably. I can't remember. On one occasion, we had all the aircraft lined up on the runway for the Queen to inspect as she went past in her car, and the squadron personnel were lined up in front. And since each crew was in front of each aircraft, and I was ahead of them in the middle, to get my voice loud enough to give commands was a bit difficult. That was when the Queen was there, and we also did a flypast for when they left Gibraltar on their way home. We flew over the Royal ship Britannia. I took the Admiral of the Fleet to Algiers on one occasion and got in bad on that because he was such a nice gentleman. And I had a special Admiral's flag made, which I hoisted over my aircraft, and all hoisted in Algiers, which I had it made principally for that purpose, for his arrival at Algiers. But it was against the law, you see. And some nosy Parker in Gibraltar found out, and I was told off. But you know, there are these nosy Parkers who like to push their fingers, and that was one.